presented by the Common Sense Institute. Welcome to Common Sense Digest, the podcast that seeks to inject a little common sense into Colorado's policy discussion. Here's your host, Earl Wright.
Welcome to the Common Sense Digest podcast. My name is Earl Wright, and I am the chairman of the board of Common Sense Institute and your host today. There is no shortage of public policy to pass through Colorado in 2024. Legislators are trying to address a state in the throes of a housing affordability crisis, an infrastructure crunch, a crime wave, post-inflation economic climate, where we're still trying to recover from 2020, a surge in migrants, a mental health crisis, a statewide homeless crisis issue, a southern border issue that we have that's impacting us in the city of Denver. On top of this array, there are issues on health care costs, to energy reform, to the environment. And of course, our lawmakers are up for the task. They've got 600 bills in 2024 General Assembly session to try to catch all of this and see if this session can't resolve much of what I just described. And helping us understand what's going on today, please join me chatting with Jake Zambrano, who is Common Sense Institute's Director of Legislative Services, who is on top of the current legislative session, and going to give us some insights that hopefully we can take away and begin to understand what's going on and what chances are of solving some of these issues. Jake, it's great to have you with us today.
Earl, as always, it's wonderful to be with you, and I always look forward to this opportunity to have a conversation with you.
Well, Jake, you've got insights that many of us would like to have because you're down there at the state capitol, and you've got a real sense of what's happening on both sides of the aisle as well as in the executive offices. Is there any sense of urgency yet with less than a month to go in this session with regards to the legislative actions that are going on? Give us a sense of the temperature of the Capitol.
You bet. That's a great question and a really good way to frame our conversation, Earl. I think that the top line is, and I always call the last month of the session, it's the time when you cut hay. It's been raining for 3 months and now the alfalfa is ready to cut and you got to put the hay in the barn. And this is when the action happens. That's sometimes a good thing and sometimes not a good thing because the pressure of the calendar a lot of times creates the need to act. And sometimes, you know, my premise in that building has always been the key for what I do and what we do is sometimes better for a bill not to pass or bill not to be heard than for government to try to fix something. And I think this is, we're now in that window of the legislative session where policymakers who are, in the trees, are sometimes missing the forest. And that's where we come in and to say, you know, hey, maybe this is something we should look at a little bit more. Maybe we should study this over the summer. And I know you have experience with interim committees, Earl, and to me, you get some of the most prudent policy-based legislation after a year or two of examination. And all policy ideas don't get that deference. And now we're in that window of that bill's hanging out there. We got to do something on migrants. We got to do something on mental health. And a lot of times they catch themselves passing something that they got to come back and fix later. So as a 20-year veteran of the building, that's always my cautionary tale to new legislators and even the reminder to leadership. Like, really think this through before you jump off the deep end on something that we may have to come back and readdress because we left some loose ends.
For all of us listening, you're making a really good point. Considering that we have both of the House and the Senate are under one party's control,
yep.
For us to be able to say that maybe the wiser decision is to maybe get more information or hey, here's more information so you can make the best decision possible on this legislation this year. I hear you saying that having people with a sense of interest and a strong insight on the particular issues and sharing that with the legislators can help them make that decision you're talking about. Like maybe we ought to think about this over the summer or, hey, if we're going to make this decision, maybe we need to make this kind of a change or that change. So outside input from people that have a strong database can be useful in a situation like this. Or am I overstating the importance of CSI in our studies?
Not at all, Earl. And you kind of took the words right out of my mouth because to me, and you and I have, I don't want to call it a fight, but we've fought this fight for the better part of 15 years trying to encourage the legislature to slow down. And you just, I'll even just peel it back to the baseline. The way they do fiscal analysis in the building, which is very static. And somebody like CSI, who does a dynamic fiscal analysis of policy questions, to me, it is the responsibility of a prudent policymaker to slow down and compare that, to look at the impacts long term that an outside group has generated based on a model and some facts that we all agree on. My working premise is always that we agree on much more than we disagree on. And so if we can agree to work together on the things we agree on, well, that was a lot of agrees, then we can begin to get first downs. New legislators are always looking for the touchdown. They always want the quick win and the big hit. And let's face it, they're politicians. So I appreciate that vantage point where they're coming from there. But I've seen a lot of good policy incrementally get passed. And I know we're going to talk about it in a little bit. But construction defects, I think, is one of those issues where we're not going to hit the home run there. It's going to take a lot of sessions, a lot of dialogue, and a lot of bills to kind of come up with a solution long term for our state when it comes to the construction of condominiums. Unfortunately, because of the one party being in control of basically all three branches of government, you sometimes get clouded and focused on what we disagree on and not what we agree on. To me, that's a cautionary note as we approach this last month. What do we agree on? Every legislator gets to introduce 5 bills. That means at a minimum, we see 500 bills. There's always late bills and orbital bills and the budget. And so, you know, 600 or 700 bills aren't uncommon. And in Colorado, every bill gets a hearing. And so every bill is analyzed and discussed. And in a public venue, the public has the opportunity to provide input. And that's a valuable piece of our process. It can also bog it down. And so in this 30-day window, they really get focused on pushing, getting bills off the calendar. And I think CSI, because we do a lot of the work that building just doesn't have the capacity to do, I know, and I've been told numerous times, we're a valuable resource for policymakers as they're examining all these things in front of them in the last couple of weeks.
Well, let's kind of step to that. There has been talk of banning from 2030 on, starting in 2030, oil and gas well drilling. We all know that's a pretty doggone significant part of the Colorado economy, and we have, as I understand it, some of the safest drilling standards being met by that by the industry in the country with regards to methane that could be escaping from a well the drilling, et cetera. But apparently that's not good enough. Jake, the CSI research has shown that after a decade, we lose 181,000 jobs if you eliminate the oil and gas industry and their drilling. That actually doesn't do anything with regards to global CO2 emissions. In fact, it works against it. We had increased by 900,000 metric tons CO2 in the atmosphere. I just cannot believe that the people who wrote this legislation understand the impact. What's going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Earl, you and I have been in this trench for a while fighting this issue. And what we have seen as Colorado has gotten more blue, and I think we can all agree Colorado's gotten more blue in the last 10 years, you have a certain number of politicians who want to take this issue, one, continue to relitigate it. Two, it's a great flashpoint for fundraising for their organizations that support this baseline policy thought. And three, helps get them reelected. The passage of Senate Bill 181 3 years ago was supposed to be the end all. And we heard it from the governor and we heard it from policymakers at the time that we got to let this work. We got to let 181. And for those of you that don't know Senate Bill 181, it basically ceded state control of oil and gas regulations to the local jurisdictions in which the operations took place. And so there was this big commitment amongst all of the companies and all of the people in government and regulators that we're going to let 181 really have the time to be effective in its communities. And to a large degree, 181 has, where those communities have embraced it and have taken it on. And it's those producing communities like Arapahoe and Adams County. It's working. The notion that we have to continue to tinker, and it's not everybody, and it's not even a Republican Democrat issue. This notion that we have to continue to find ways to tighten the noose around the head of oil and gas, and no acknowledgement of, I mean, I'm a futurist, e-cars and a transition, and like you can't avoid the fact that that's going to happen and is happening. What you have to also embrace, though, is that transition, natural gas is a huge piece of that transition. And whether that's 20 years or 40 years or 60 years, none of us know. To try to tighten that noose real time by putting into effect statewide regulations that would make it nearly impossible to produce. It's just irresponsible. It's irresponsible for school children. It's irresponsible for infrastructure, and it's irresponsible for the economy of our state. And I say that because of the revenue, the tax base that oil and gas spins off, that benefits any number of people and stakeholders and communities in our state. To just want to cut that off one day, by a date certain is just without replacing it with something is irresponsible. And that's why you see most of the time, and I knock on wood when I say this, cooler heads prevail. They walk back from these flashpoint policy ideas. And Senate Bill 159 is a good example of that, where Senator Priola and Senator Hawkes Lewis proclaimed that all oil and gas permitting shall end in Colorado by 2030. That's just irresponsible. That's not thinking the issue through. And whether or not you believe that the transition will be over by then, I think is moot. I think it's selling our school children short. It's selling our K through 12 capital construction short. It's selling our road and bridges short and how we build our state budget, which is why that bill died in its first hearing. The conversation is important, but at some point you have to step back and just let policy work. And unfortunately, with term limits, we seem to have these new legislators that are always wanting to tinker, and that's just not helpful.
So the bill's not going forward.
No, sir. The bill
died. That's good. And I guess the thing that really struck me in the CSI study was the severance tax and the contributions that the industry is making to the state economy, jobs and the salary levels, as well as the impact on the school system in the communities that the oil and gas industry was producing. As you said, how in the world do you replace that? But the bottom line, which, and I don't want to belabor this, which really, I think really surprised me, is that it wasn't accomplishing what it was intended to do, and that is make the environment safer or better, because all you were doing is transferring the very carbon emissions you're trying to eliminate into less efficient states that would produce the energy or fossil fuels that would be needed to replace Colorado. I think hopefully people got the message. It's like you said, they'll have a chance to think about it over the summer and say, hey, wait a minute, let this rest and move on. We've already got legislation in place. Okay, enough. Jake, let's move into the arena of, you call it SB 24103, which has to do with the developing new condos. We have one new condo for every 14 apartments at the present time, and that's way out of balance. That's not producing the number of condos or affordable housing that you would normally like to see. And normally, we've seen in the past one new condo for 1.25 new apartments. That is way out of balance. And we all know that we've got a big housing problem in the state with regards to affordable housing. What's going on down at the state legislature to help us get this back in balance?
You bet, Earl. And that's a great question. And there's a lot of people focused on this policy question down at the Capitol. Senate Bill 106, they refer to in the short title is the right to remedy. 6 or 7 years ago, CSI set out in a partnership with a couple of policymakers that were in the Capitol at the time, Alec Garnett and Cole Wist, to start to really address this issue that we, as an organization, CSI, pointed out 6 or 7 years ago. Why is condominium building on the decline? And it became very clear very quickly that builders weren't willing to take the risk in building condominiums when the lawsuit exposure, the litigation exposure was so great to them. And to me, it really underscores the downside of single party power in Colorado, because it doesn't force negotiation. It doesn't force compromise. Essentially, the trial lawyers, the trial bar, has created an environment where if a new condominium complex is built, all they have to do is go find one owner to have one issue, and they file a lawsuit against that builder, and it essentially freezes all progress within that complex until that lawsuit is resolved. And so it's a tactic that I think the trial bar uses from not a genuine place, frankly. It is a very unproductive. It ties up people's investments, and it doesn't give the builder the opportunity to fix the issue. And so Senate Bill 106 is attempting to create some sideboards around that way of doing business, that if a homeowner has an issue, and let's face it, we've all bought a new home at some point in our lives, or a lot of us have. And yeah, there are, checklists and punch lists and issues that arise and settling and whatnot that happens. And you got to give the builder an opportunity to go in and fix it. To run to court right away and try to sue the builder for being disingenuous or building a shoddy product, is irresponsible. And if I'm a home builder, and the home builders have reacted this way, they just stopped building condominiums. And it's unfortunate because the condominium is the entry point, and it was the entry point for a lot of us and will be the entry point for a lot of Coloradans, young Coloradans, to start to build wealth in it being an affordable option to buy a piece of property and create a roof over their head that isn't making somebody else rich, but it's creating a baseline of an investment for themselves. And the trial bar has single-handedly shut that off.
Yeah, I really appreciate the thoroughness of your explanation as to what has gone on. I know that in our own firm, we have young people here that would love to have a chance to buy a house. And the delay that's occurring because of the cost, the entry, and today's interest rates with regards to mortgages, which have pretty much doubled the cost of a mortgage with regards to young people trying to get into some kind of a accommodation of where they own it. And then to talk about not having something available in the range of the 250 up to 350 range, maybe 400 to get something started. That's difficult for them. In fact, it's made Colorado less attractive for some people coming into the state. And studies that we've shown, it's shown the in-migration to the state has slowed down. I don't know that it's because of that. There are other issues, of course, to take into account. But hey, let's move on to something else that talks about the future of the state, and that is to do with education. Our education fellow, Jason Galdon, has been engaged in the future of the Colorado workforce. He has written what I consider a must-read report, The Supply and Demand Diagnosing Colorado Skills and Attainment Gap. And I don't care if you're retired or not, and even if you're a millennial, listen to this, but it really talks about what we have a need of in the state of Colorado, really producing through the educational system what we need. And I was astonished to read the misalignment that's occurring in the post-secondary education arena as far as the credentials. You know, we may be producing some well-educated people, but we only need so many sociologists, and we may need only so many people that are in the area of construction, which I was surprised by. But we need some other areas where STEM, but yet he and his group points out how we can resolve that over time if we take advantage of some things that are already in place, like Luminance and ColoradoFuturesJobs.com, where people can line up, and also things that need to be done at the K through 12 arena. How does the state legislature see this, or are they as attuned to it as we might be in the public policy arena at the present time, Jake? Can you give us an insight as to what's going on down there relative to what I just said?
Earl, this is a very exciting subject area, in my view. I started out my career in higher education, and so have always been a wonk when it comes to attainment and higher ed and what does the future look like for Colorado young people. In this legislative session and kind of this window of time that we're in under this Governor Polis has really challenged kind of all levels of education to reexamine the types of programs that students are being offered. And whether that be at the K-12 level or at the community college level or at the four-year university level, this governor has said to everyone, hey, I'm not just going to keep throwing good money after bad for it. Earl, in your words, more sociologists. Let's really dig in and figure out where is the gap? What does industry need? And how do we address that? And I think that the schools and the higher ed institutions that are going to win in all of this are going to be the ones that respond to that question, because you're exactly right. We may or may not have enough psychologists in Colorado already, but what we know we don't have enough of is tradespeople, framers and HVAC, people that know mechanical services. These are the type of jobs that are really good paying jobs that after 2, 3, or 4 years of education, you'll have no problem going out and finding six-figure work. And to me, it's about a ladder. It's about, and nursing has proven this out. The nursing ladder from assistant to bachelor's of nursing to master's of nursing, the data shows that once you get into a career field, people want to progress in that career field. So if we can create an entry point for students who don't see themselves as traditional college students, we're only doing ourselves better. And groups like Rocky Mountain Mechanical Contractors partnering with the university, with Colorado State University and creating a construction trade school. CSU has responded well. The community colleges have been phenomenal in this space in creating ladders of workforce and helping students attain the next step in their education. And I love what fellow Galdon has done in his research. He's kind of taken all that and bundled it up and said, okay, we got a good start, but now let's press. Let's press our bet. Let's take it to the next step. Let's try and create even more opportunities. And we are at that beautiful flashpoint where you finally have buy-in from all these stakeholders. So now let's go act on it.
The report, and I encourage everybody to take a look at it, because the report is outlined specifically by various job categories, all the way from business and financial operations down to farming and fishing, et cetera. And I was really taken back that, you know, we have 8.2% of the population in the business and finance operations, but by 2031, we'll need 13. And then you go down to areas like architecture and engineering, which I was quite surprised that we have 8.6% being met by the population, but we're going to need 3.6% in 2021. That really surprised me. But then you go into the area of healthcare practitioner technical, like you said, you know, we're about 1% lower than what we need. This study just lays out what we need over the next 10 years. It's challenging us. God love Governor Polis for saying, hey, we've got to take a look at this and see how we match up and how the educational programs can match up. And I guess I got to go back to the question that I kind of want to restate again, if I could, is there anything going on in the legislature that is encouraging the K-12 or higher ed to match up better with what the needs might be relative to what they are currently is being produced out of our education system?
Earl, I think that's an important piece that we need to examine. The purse usually does control the decision-making process in the Capitol, and the legislature does control a bucket of money that they call capital construction dollars. And over the last 4 or 5 years, the Capital Development Committee, which is six members, it's a bipartisan year-round committee, six members of the legislature that are tasked with examining all the capital infrastructure in Colorado, which includes a huge portfolio in higher education.
Right.
And where you invest future dollars into that portfolio. And fortunately, for the last 4 or 5 years, the Capital Development Committee, in partnership with the Joint Budget Committee and the entire legislature, has really invested money in workforce development, workforce training areas. And they've also encouraged and created a little bit, the state's not a matching grant, but if you will, like as you or I would know it, but they've encouraged a lot of institutions to go out and find public-private partnerships, bring a little bit of cash to the table as an institution. Don't just come and need your full project funded. Bring a little bit of cash to the table as an institution and say, hey, we're going to build this architectural and engineering partnership at Mesa with the University of Colorado. And we have one corporate sponsor, but we need a little state funding for a building. And those are the type of partnerships that are really budding right now. And I think it's in direct response to where students who are in this conversation, for all intents and purposes, buyers. They are buyers of a piece of paper, of a diploma, of a credential that allows them to go out into the world and seek employment using that credential. I think higher ed in Colorado is finally starting to realize that. And it's been a long process, because a lot of times it was, we're just going to create all these programs in academia and you kind of force yourself into the programming. Whereas now I'm seeing a lot more at the community college, especially level of, hey, you know, this industry needs more technical welders. And so we're going to create a welding program at our community college to respond to that skill set. And it just works up from there. Nursing is a classic example in Colorado. Colorado has led the way on nursing ladders in the country, I believe. And it's because we have a lot of access points. And then the schools partner with one another to allow their students to stay home, work in their profession, raise their families, put roots down in communities but also and online education has just revamped the way we do higher ed now.
I want to push on one topic, with only which I'm very being consumed by it. AI, for example, the fintech world and all these things that are cutting edge with in the world of finance and banking right now. We're all, I guess, either know about it or we're being introduced and it's becoming a part of who we are and what we're doing. That means computers and mathematics and people with computer and mathematical backgrounds. And the study says that we've got about half of what we need for 2030. Is there any area like that where there's a specificity of looking at the future in kind of the tech area and saying, hey, we're short here and we've got to cover this? Or is that just being covered with all the other general applications of improvements we're trying to put in place?
Yeah, that's hard to say, because as AI has just sort of barnstormed the conversation around policy and how we what's next in that realm, it's hard to say. But what is clear is, and K-12 has done a good job in creating STEM only environments for students that want to matriculate to that specialty area, to where you can go and focus on science and tech and math in a building that was created to help foster that willingness. And it's hard to say where that all goes. I mean, academia will sit in the room and tell you we're ahead of it. We're on it. We've created an environment that can take as many students in this discipline as want to come. And I think we can all agree that the last chapter on AI and how that all ends is none of us know. And so it's kind of the brave new world now.
Okay. But to what I hear you saying, it's not a unique conversation.
No.
With regards to how do we, from the educational perspective, handle that issue going forward. Hey, I've got a follow-up, if I could. In light of what's going on down at the Capitol, what's getting the most attention and what's getting the most testimony? What may be number one focus for us may not be the number one focus down there. Can you give us an insight as to the answer to that question?
Yeah, and unfortunately, Earl, I don't think it's great news. Crime and law and order seem to still be at the top, on the top of minds of everyday rank and file Coloradans. And how this legislature has responded to that in the last two or three sessions, in my opinion, has not been great. And I will give you one brief example. Last week, as the body was debating early release / bond relief for felons, they were also making it illegal for a law enforcement officer to put a suspect in the prone position. And to me, it's a huge disconnect. Who are we trying to protect here? Where are we placing value on our citizenry as a legislative body? And to me, it's a really slippery slope. And I don't want to diminish the thinking of the policymakers that want to give second, third, and fourth chances and figure out how you rehabilitate and figure out how you help somebody get reintegrate back into their community. That's a great goal. But ultimately, our society is always going to have bad people, and bad people need to be, it's the government's responsibility to protect the good people from the bad people.
Help me out. A prone position, is that something that the officer, the sheriff or the policeman is in fact physically doing something to the company? Or is that where they are asking the suspect to lay on the ground in a certain way where they won't be able to attack the officer or sheriff or less inclined to?
Yeah, it's a restraint technique that law enforcement uses in the field when they've apprehended a suspect. And it's effective, and it keeps the officer safe. It keeps the suspect safe, and it allows the officer in a lot of times to wait for backup to arrive so that they can continue on with the procedure of the arrest without exposing harm to themselves. Because you basically, for a second or two, it gives you a second or two of reaction time if the suspect were to not obey commands and try to resist and or escape and fight. To make this technique illegal in Colorado is just, it's dangerous for law enforcement. We're already having enough hard of a time recruiting and retaining law enforcement in Colorado, that to continue to make it more difficult for them to do their jobs and protect us from bad people is just bad policy. And it brings out the moms and dads and the everyday people who never envisioned themselves walking into the Capitol to give their opinion on a topic, on a subject matter. It brings them out more than any other topic, because in the last 5 years, and a couple of our studies have underscored this, more and more of us have been touched by crime in Colorado, and that's not a good thing. And for our policymakers to not see the good law-abiding people and put them a little bit ahead of the criminal, I think is just a dangerous way to legislate. And it's just a baseline premise from where you approach this from. Like, some people believe that everyone can be rehabilitated. I don't know that that's the case. I'm not an expert. I'm not one of those sociologists that can decide that, but I sure as heck know that if my family's going to a ball game at Coors Field on a Saturday night in downtown Denver, that I want to feel safe, and that if I do need law enforcement, that they have the tools at their disposal to keep my family safe. And I'm not sure we're creating that type of environment in Colorado right now.
I'm not real certain why denying a prone position has anything to do with the person being arrested and their rights, other than we're asking them to restrain themselves in a certain way until a backup or other things can be done to decide what to do with them. But that's, I guess I don't understand it, but that's my problem, not anybody else's. What do you still expect to emerge from this session? That I know we're down to the last 30 days, and inevitably there's always that late night session where we didn't know that something was going to occur, and it does. Can you give us some insights?
Yeah, I think that we're going to see some work around the Regional Transportation District, RTD. Not quite sure what that's going to look like, but for the 7 RTD counties in the metro area, that will be a big deal. I think we will see a likelihood that another shoe will drop on construction defects. There's a working group right now that's trying to get a second bill introduced that would also help. I talked about first downs, would also help get us to a first down. And then I think the marquee issue still to be debated that we've not even seen language on yet is property taxes. We have been at the forefront of that conversation. What the solution looks like is very different between different stakeholder groups, the governor included. And I think there will be a proposal to offer continued relief to Coloradans. So we'll just have to wait and see. That will be hotly contested, hotly debated. That'll be all on the backdrop of a November 2024 election that also has a property tax question on its ballot already. And so to me, that'll be the headliner. This last 30 days will be property taxes.
But the idea would be that somehow give us relief, whether it's as much as we'd want or not. Is that a fair conclusion?
I think that the agreement is yes, more relief. How that's paid for is the debate, Earl. And the governor, I think, is wanting to pull a lot of that buy down from Tabor refunds. It is against the spirit and the letter of Tabor in all the ways. But as you know, they find ways to work around Tabor all the time. And I think this is the line in the sand that a lot of the groups are going to draw and just not stand for it. So that's the.
I find all of this, I must admit, baffling, because the property tax increases that have occurred in the last 12 months, of which I have participated in, that's newfound money. So why is there some relief that needs to be made if that money was never there 24 months ago? And all you're saying is, guess what? We're not going to collect as much of something that we never had 24 months ago. I don't understand why all of a sudden we have to find relief. Explain that to me, Jake, if you can. And if you don't want to, just say, Earl, take your question someplace else.
Yeah. And I don't know, that would require a little bit of getting in the head of some of the legislators who get to make this decision, budget committee members and high ranking Democrats that are driving this negotiation. It's never been lost on me that the opportunity for a legislator to have more money to spend on a priority area that they think is a priority will always trump the taxpayer. And I think it's unfortunate, because you create this insatiable need to continue to spend, and it's just unhealthy. It's unhealthy for our budget, and thank goodness for Tabor, because it at least attempts to keep the legislature in check. But for them to cede $1 without a fight, whether it was expected or unexpected, is just, I've never seen that. Discipline doesn't really exist in the Capitol, and it's unfortunate, which is why you need good, strong third-party groups that are willing to fight the fight when and if necessary.
You know, one of the things that we just recently did is a congressional budget study, CSI did, and they weren't trying to argue for one thing or another, but they really we really did a good job of identifying, well, where are the budget dollars going to and what has been the historical evolution of budget and employment in the state of Colorado. I would encourage any of our podcast listeners to go to that report. It's on the CSI website, and it does a beautiful job of giving the history and what is happening in the state budget so that we as citizens can see how things have evolved. And, you know, we may all have our own independent judgment as to it's evolved the way we think it should or not, but at least we're informed. And I think that's what you're suggesting to us here, is that there are things going on and people have certain, I guess, philosophies with regards to how they want to continue to pursue things at the state level. But let's understand what the aggregate impact is on us as citizens. And that's a good study for us to understand. Jake, yeah. I'm not going to take any more of your time because you've done such a marvelous job down at the Capitol building representing the R's and the D's and making certain that people understand what's going on down there. And thank you for taking the time today. Anything else you want to say in closing?
Earl, always a pleasure, and I enjoy these conversations, and I look forward to catching up when the dust settles and we know what we got after this session. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
It's always a pleasure, Jake, and thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you for listening to the Common Sense Digest. For more on today's topic, as well as our research on the most pressing public policy issues facing Colorado, please visit commonsenseinstituteco.org. The preceding episode, along with all others, is available on podcatchers everywhere or on our website under the podcast tab. Our technical producer is John Ekstrom and Deft Communications. This has been a production of the Common Sense Institute.